chapter 32. It's okay. It's okay. We are, again, remember, doing sort of broad strokes. In fact, next week, you'll come, if you come, we'll be talking about King David. So, woo, big jump, right? Now, the reason we're doing that is often I hear people, well, I don't understand what's going on in the Bible, and it's all confusing, and it's really not at all confusing if you have context, right? It's like anything. You read a verse, and, I mean, you don't know what it means because you don't have the context of it. So the point of this fall's sermon series, Our Covenant God, is to sort of demonstrate and understand the whole context. And this, last week we talked about Exodus chapter 19, where we said grace comes first. Remember that? God brings the people out of Egypt. They didn't do anything. It was free. And he tells them, I did this. I came and got you. Totally of my own doing, not yours. Wings of eagles, imagery, and all that. It's not about you. It's about what I did for you. It starts at grace. And then he says, now if you'll obey me, here's the blessing. So that's kind of what we were talking about. And this is another important scene because it comes right on the heels of that. And it gives us a little bit of understanding of what it means, what God's looking for when he says obey. And maybe even what he's talking about when he says blessing. I think what we're looking at in these chapters, and that's the title. I hate sermon titles. I don't do that well. But in this case, I titled this, How to Be a Worshiping Community. That's what this teaches us, is what it looks like. How are we supposed to be a worshiping community? So, we're going to do something a little different through here. I'm still not comfortable with this because, you know, I like 3 points and a boom, you know, we're done. But we're going to kind of look through, and I'm going to read several places as we go through here to kind of get an idea of what's being said. And if you want to study this more, you'll have the tools, I think, to kind of understand what the parts that I may just fly right over. So let me pray for us. God, thank you. Thank you that you are our God, that you brought us out away from ourselves, maybe backgrounds, struggles, sin. You have rescued us, and you are rescuing us. Help us to rest in that truth and to believe that with all that we are. And then as we talk today, as we study your word, I pray you'd open our ears to understand the things that you would have us to know. It's in your name. Amen. All right. So, 20 through 32. And the Lord, no, I'm just kidding. I wouldn't read the whole thing. We'd be here for 3 hours. Although it's valuable. Chapter 20 is the Ten Commandments. Essentially, there's some more stuff at the end, but it begins with, these are the Ten Commandments, which is a really good place to start. If you want to know what obedience means, you look at the Ten Commandments. But we're going to move on. Because I've preached on the Ten Commandments, did a whole series on that. You can find it in the archive. We can talk about it. But what follows is somewhat of a drawing out of an understanding of, let's get more specific. You know, you're supposed to love your neighbor. Well, what's that look like? That's what the next several chapters are. How we can, I cut it down to this, how to be a community. That's what these laws are. 21 verse 2, when you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years, and the seventh he shall go out free for nothing. Now, a lot of times the Bible has been used to justify slavery. The Bible was used in our own country, not even 2 centuries ago, to say it's okay to have slaves. Now, this was written into a different culture, in a place where slavery, people had slaves. Everybody did. But what's being taught, maybe, hopefully, none of us ever owned slaves. So we'd say, well, this rule is irrelevant to me, right? But what's being taught in this is not, it's okay to own slaves. What's being taught in this is every person has an inherent dignity and value in them. Theologically, we go back to chapter 2 of Genesis and say that's because they were made in the image of God. in the story. And in their context, there were other people who treated certain people from maybe as a socioeconomic class or sometimes ethnic, racial groups. For whatever reason, this person is less than me. And God is teaching the people, no, people have an inherent dignity because at a certain point, you set that slave free. It's about setting them free. It's about changing the way everybody else does things. It's actually about being different, not like the rest of the culture. So that made me think, okay, how do we flesh that out for us in our context? Think about who are the people that we think less of, look down on maybe, think maybe, well, they don't quite have it right. Maybe it's young people, maybe it's old people, somebody in another socioeconomic class, somebody of another race. We do that. I think God's word, the principle that we get from this is that we can't do that. Maybe, here's a good one, maybe it's specific sins. You know, well, I know I'm greedy, but they're gay. Right? Do we look down on other people and think they are beneath us for any reason at all? I think the principle that's coming out of this is that, no, we're all equal, equally under sin, equally broken, equally under the grace of Christ. So we need to be careful about how we interact. That's just an idea. Another, how to be in community. This is one of my favorites. Now you're going to think, yeah, that doesn't really apply to me. But just hear me out. Chapter 21, verse 35. When one man's ox, so if any of you have oxen, think about this. When one man's ox butts another's so that it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and share its price, and the dead beast they shall also share. Or if it is known that the ox has been accustomed to gore in the past and its owner has not kept it in, he shall repay ox for ox and a dead beast shall be his. Now there's two things going on here. So for those of you in you have oxen in your backyard, pay attention. This matters. If your ox kills the other guy's ox, you share both ox. That's the deal. You got to give up. The live ox is more valuable than the dead one. So you split both in half. You're responsible for your own accidents. That means if you're shoveling the driveway and you throw it too far onto your neighbor's driveway or your snowblower kicks it over there, you can't just leave it. That we're about being responsible to correct even the accidents that happen. This is about being a good neighbor. But it goes further. It says, if it's known that the ox gores, then you give them the live one and you take the dead one. There's a greater sense of responsibility if you didn't really. It's not even about intentionality, it's about carelessness. It's about if you know this could happen and you didn't try to stop it, then you're more responsible than if you didn't know. You see how this can transfer to us learning how to be good neighbors. We shouldn't, here's another thing to think about. The other person that gets the live ox and gives up their dead one now, right? They're not going back seeking more. It's over now. They've let go. They've forgiven the fault. It's been made up. I think sometimes in our culture, we tend to, man, I'm going to drive at you and I'm going to get everything I can out of you because you hurt me. You knew this about your dog and it killed my grass. You know, whatever it is, the sod's been replaced. You're still angry and you can't wait to get at them. We do these kinds of things all the time, and this is the principle that's coming here. One is personal responsibility on the part of the offending party. The other is willingness to forgive and let it go on the part of the other. See how this creates a much stronger and better community? another one about ox, 23:4. If you meet your enemy's ox, if you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall bring it back to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying down under its burden, so it's on the ground, you know, I had to think about this because I haven't been around donkeys a whole lot. But it's laying down under its burden. It can't get up and it needs help. It says, you shall refrain from leaving him with it. You shall rescue it with him. Your enemy and the one who hates you. So some of us have neighbors that we struggle to get along with. Sort of modern day translation for us would be, if you see someone breaking into their house or walking around with flashlights looking in their windows, you're supposed to do something about it. Most of us would probably do that, I like to think. You can see how this helps us be a better community. Even here in the church, when we look out for people who, but then none of us have people we struggle to have relationships with in church, do we? Do we look out for those people? Do we seek their best interest even when we don't want to? Another one from verse 10 of 23. For 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its yield, but the seventh year you shall let it rest, that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the beasts of the field may eat. You should do likewise with your vineyard and with your olive orchard. Now, again, we're like, what? Here's what they did. Every 7 years, the farmers would just walk away. But the poor would come and plant and use the land to feed themselves. The poor of the poor may eat. That's the point. It's a choice. The law is a demand that those who have means make a choice to not be greedy, but to be merciful or to be charitable. Now, this is tricky. It's very tricky because we live in a culture where we're trying to decide who's responsible for that, right? I don't want to get into that. It's not even important because this is to a nation who was supposed to be God's nation, the only nation that ever existed that was supposed to be God's nation. Okay, this was a law for a government that was ordered around God as king. That nation doesn't exist anymore, and we're not that nation. But I will say this. I'm going to give you an example of somebody that I think exemplifies it, and he got a lot of flack for it. There's a guy named Dan Price, owns a credit card processing company out in Seattle, made major headlines about 9-10 months ago, I guess. He decided he was going to make a minimum wage in his company of $70,000 a year. Now, he got a lot of flack. I mean, some people got like double their income type of raises because he had people on the payroll at $35,000. And people didn't like this because people didn't like minimum wage sort of thing. But let me say this. What he was doing was not establishing a national minimum wage or any kind of external requirement that anyone make anyone else do anything. This man made a decision to go from $1.1 million a year annual income to $70,000. And then to give his employees significant raises. That is, if nothing else, I think it exemplifies the principle of this rule. That we make a choice to have less for us that others may have more. That's what that rule is. I think we Christians can think through how are ways we can do that. Maybe we can't go to our employer and say, I need you to give me a pay cut. Maybe we can. Maybe we are our employer and we can do that. Maybe it's just a matter of finding other helpful, wise, intelligent ways to give our money away, because there's some really bad ones out there. So be careful when you do that. But I do think it is a choice to have less and give more. Whatever that might look like, I think is worth considering. It's interesting, there's another place that I thought of as I was going through this stuff on community and what that looks like. There's this commonly quoted verse in the New Testament. Jesus says something about where two or more are gathered in my name, I am there with them. And it's often used to talk about worship and what worship is. So I just want to point out something. This is from Matthew 18. I'm going to read from verse 15 following. If your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. Deal with it. Be honest about it. Confront it. If he listens to you, you have gained your brother. But if he does not listen, take one or two others along with you. Every charge may be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector, as an outsider. That's what that means. Truly I say to you, whatever you bind on earth, you shall bind in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. And I say to you, if two or more agree about anything they ask, it will be done for them. For where there are two or three gathered in my name, there I am among them. That is about worship. But it's about worship in the context of community. We think we can have one without the other. As we will shortly see, we can't. These are principles about living in community and being in worship that transfer. This is not Old Testament stuff. This is Bible stuff. These things, dealing honestly with one another, doesn't change when Jesus dies on the cross or when he gets up from the grave. This is something that happens that we're called to do. Now, changing gears for just a minute, chapter 24 changes a little bit. Moses has gotten these rules, and he comes to the people and he says, verse 3, he came to the people and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules. And the people answered with one voice and said, all the words of the Lord we will obey. Everything he's spoken we will do. And then he kills an animal, he burns it. This is a terribly visual, graphic culture. Think about the smells and the sounds. When he kills this animal and he fills, it says he took half the blood and put it in basins and then he threw the rest against an altar. Then, verse 7, he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do. We will be obedient. And it says Moses took the blood and threw it on the people. Think about that. It's graphic. People standing out, he's got a bowl full of blood, and he goes like that, right? You're going to feel that. You're going to smell that. You're going to taste it. He throws the blood on the people, and he says, behold, the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. Now, that's a fascinating phrase. It's a phrase that you would expect to be repeated quite often. It's not. It appears very infrequently, actually, blood of the covenant. Another time it appears is when Jesus holds up a cup and says, this is the blood of the covenant. It's really interesting. And the reason, now why would I go and explain all of this? It seems so icky. We don't want to talk about that. But the people needed to experience a death. They needed that reminder of just how serious their sin was. They needed the reminder that in order to enter into covenant with God, death was required. And not just the beasts. In a sense, we'd use a fancy word. We call it substitutionary atonement. Something else substitutes for us. However, in that act, we too, in a sense, die. Same way in the New Testament. It works the same way with the cross. We also die. We die to self. We die to selfishness. We recognize in the death of another the death of our own stuff that needs to die. We put that away. And then fascinatingly enough, Moses and the elders then turn around and have a meal. They eat and drink in celebration of this new covenant. I wonder if that sounds familiar as we think about the way we celebrate the Lord's Supper. Now, again, I'm speeding through. We're getting a broad view of what's going on. After they've eaten, Moses goes up on the mountain. Verse 15, I'm going to read verse 15. When Moses went up on the mountain, the cloud covered the mountain. The glory of the Lord dwelt on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. Now the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a devouring fire on top of the mountain in the sight of the people of Israel. This is what they saw. This is what they heard. This is where Moses went into. Moses entered the cloud and went up on the mountain. And Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. That is going to become important. In this 40 days and 40 nights, Moses is going to receive instructions now for worship. It was community. Now it's worship. How do we be a worshiping community? God has said, this is what you need to do for each other. Now he's going to say, this is what you need to do for me. As they go up there, God says to Moses, in the next seven chapters are going to be God dealing with how to worship, all the way up through 31. Several things, I'm not going to go through everything. The Ark of the Covenant, we've all heard of that. We've seen the Indiana Jones movie. It's the chest where they carried the tablets of the Ten Commandments. It was the presence of God was there, and there's this entire setup, and you need to read all of this, and it's worth going through slowly, but I want us to step back. You can tell I'm struggling not telling you all of this, but one I do want to tell you is this table, the next thing, it's in verse 23 through 30, it's about the table for the bread of presence. Very clear, you know, you need to be like this kind of wood, you need to cover it with gold, it's got all these ornamental stuff, and it's used for one thing and one thing only, is for this bread, actually 12 loaves of bread, to sit on. It's right next to, in the structure of the tabernacle, everything at this point is built so they can carry it, they got poles on everything, and they're wandering around the desert, and wherever they stop to camp, they set this big thing up, big as this room, with a section here for the Holy of Holies where the Ark will sit alone, and there's this big tent around it. Right outside that door, right outside the Holy of Holies, is this table of the bread of presence. This is the bread that is next to God. We don't quite know exactly what's implied, what's meant, but here's a few ideas just to give you some understanding. The priests would eat this bread at the end of every week. And they'd put new bread, always 12 loaves. Now, Jesus, what's something he says a lot? He says, I am the bread of life. Repeatedly. This is a thing he uses. It's interesting that when he feeds the 5,000 in John chapter 6, and they finish eating, you know, it starts with like, you know, five loaves and two fish. Maybe I got that backwards. He feeds them, everybody eats, and they gather this up. Why are we told how much is left over? So we're 12 baskets of bread. I think Jesus is trying to illustrate to the people all along through the New Testament period, you know, the bread that is with God, that allows you to eat in the presence of God? That's me. All of these elements are like that. Everything here demonstrates the majesty and authority of God, and yet his accessibility through the cross, ultimately through Christ. Everything points forward there. Now, one thing that's interesting is as you read this, and it gets very specific. You know, you got to wear this kind of hat. You got to paint this thing, and the golden lampstand will be the next thing. It's very ornate. Leaves have to be on it just this way. It's, I think, points back to the tree of life and forward to the light of the world. These are the images that we see here. So it's pretty strict about how it has to be done. When you read that, you think, is this okay? I think it's fair. I think it's reasonable to come and say, you know, God is awful demanding of worship. Well, let's be honest. What would you all think of me if I said, if I demanded that you all tell me every day how great I am? It's not cool. Let's admit it. We don't like those traits in people. It seems selfish. C.S. Lewis had the same struggle. The guy that wrote the Narnia books and now the movies, which are all really good. The new ones. Don't watch the BBC. Watch the new movies. Somebody has seen the BBC because I heard a little laugh. But he had a similar struggle to that. When he even after he became a Christian, before and even after becoming a Christian, he struggled with, God seems demanding that we worship him, and that doesn't seem right. And even the fact God says he has this right to be praised, I mean, it's great to kind of sit back and receive it, but when you talk about this is how you're going to worship me, and you're going to do it this way, and you better, you know, it seems harsh to some of us, I think. It's fair to admit it. But Lewis came to this conclusion that he realized that it's not only that God receives something in worship, it's actually in worship that God gives himself to men. It's there that God meets his worshipers. And we were made to worship. We need that. We need a connection with God, and we need to worship. This is what Lewis says to prove that. The world rings with praise. Lovers praising their beloved, readers their favorite poet, walkers praising the countryside, sports fans their favorite team, praise of weather, wines, dishes, actors, motors, horses, colleges, countries, historical persons, children, flowers, mountains, rare stamps, rare beetles, sometimes even politicians and scholars. We praise all the time because we must. We were made for it. The thing is, we are most fully alive when we are most fully doing what we were made to do. We were made to worship. And what is the one thing in the universe most praiseworthy, most admirable? And yet most of us spend our time praising, admiring, and adoring lesser things. And we don't feel really alive, I think, for that reason. We must worship the one thing that is most praiseworthy. Now, Lewis, once he came to this conclusion, he also realized that we're not great at it. He said, even in church, 99.9% of the time, we're falling short of even what we might call worship. We struggle to do it. Our hearts, our minds are distracted. He used this illustration. Sometimes worship on a regular basis, corporate worship, is like digging ditches in a dry desert land. He'd say we were doing that to prepare for the deluge of joy that was going to come and flood the ditches and make these canals. But what we experience on a regular basis is sometimes as we're digging those ditches, we'll get a little trickle that runs through, and we feel this exuberance, this joy of this is what it's supposed to be like, but it's so small compared to what's coming. But Lewis said, we have to do that. Worship, corporate, community worship, is essential to us because we're so short-sighted. We're so messed up. We so easily become distracted. I mean, let's be honest. I'd bet every one of us here would admit, if we think through our week, that we've spent more time admiring things other than our Creator than we've spent admiring Him. It's easy to do. That's why regular worship is so important. I think of the song, Come Thou Fount, that has the words, oh, to grace, how great a debtor, daily I'm constrained to be. Let thy goodness like a fetter bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. And when we sing that, I pray that when we sing it with the recognition and the confession that we are prone to wander and the admission that we need to come back to the fount of grace all the time. And we need to do it with community, to hear you all singing those words that we sang earlier, to hear you worshiping steals me against my own flesh. and against the world that is going to pound down on me to not worship, to call my heart away every second of every minute of every day. And I need you regularly. I need worship regularly to remind me and to call me back home. And here's why. Because of what follows. Now, it's safe to assume that in 40 days the people have not worshiped, because Moses didn't know how to. He was gone, and they didn't have their rules down. They didn't know what to do. They didn't have a leader there doing it. And it's also interesting. Chapter 32, verse 1, we see something I think that kind of stands out. When the people saw, this is 46 days Moses has been gone, 46 days. Doesn't seem like a long time. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain. Now, anyway, 46 days ago, they had seen what we just read, the presence of God on top of the mountain trembled and it was powerful and whatever those words were. It was a sight to behold. 46 days later, when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. Not long ago, God said, I brought you out of Egypt, and they said, we'll do everything you say. Right? Now they're saying, Moses has been gone 46 days. They haven't worshipped in 46 days. They've been focused on a man, not community, for this time. They're looking at Moses as the one who brought him out. They're looking all straight toward Moses. They're not looking to each other. They're not trying to be a community. They're trying to be a bunch of followers. They failed on the community front, and they failed on the worship front. And they make a calf, and they hold it up out of gold, and they say, this is your God who brought you out of Egypt. They have turned to full-scale idolatry because of no community and no worship. Now, here's the thing. I've said this myself, and I understand what people mean, and I hear other people say it, that you know, I can worship Jesus, it's just me and him, it's fine. And I believe that, theologically. I absolutely believe that. But I think there's something to the community that I think our culture discourages us from actively, teaches us, you don't need that. Organized religion. I hear that phrase a lot, and it's never a positive thing. And honestly, I understand why. I'm a part of a church. I see, you think you've seen some problems with our church? I see them all. We're all messed up. And anything we build will be messed up. If you want the perfect church, well, make sure you hide in your bathroom on Sunday mornings. It'll just be you and nobody to disagree with you. It'll be perfect. But we tend to hide from one another, and we tend not to be here. I hear this a lot, and I get it. Now, here's the thing. If you've not been here for 6 weeks or eight or a year, or if you've never been in church before and you're here, no shame. Please hear that. This is not about shame. This is not about you better be here next week or else. That's not the point at all. We're prone to do that because we're prone to wander. We're prone to make this about us and maybe our perceived mistakes or maybe real mistakes or whatever. Here's the thing. What we see with lack of community and lack of worship is a turning away. It's a warning. It's not a shame, it's a warning. I listen to a regular podcast, comes out every weekday, and I heard some really interesting statistics in it this week. Across America, of people 50 years old and older, 65% of you were married in a church building. Okay? Of people 30 and younger who are married, 39% married in a church building. Now, that's a, you know, whatever. But here's what it does. And if you weren't married in a church building, this is not about that, okay? So, again, please don't hear what I'm not saying. It's not about shame. What I think it shows is a cultural trend, and there's lots of other data points that bear this same reality out, a cultural trend that finds the church to be somewhat irrelevant to life. You know? I mean, there are people who want, you know, say a baptism for their baby, but they've not been in the building in over a year. You know, this is the sort of this tension that we see. The value of the community and the value of the worship is not present. Now, I know that many of us have noted sort of moral, cultural decline, whatever kind of phrasing you want to use for that in our culture. And I'd agree. I think there is a definite change. I think we are living in a time of significant change in our culture. But I want to say, church, we often look out here and we go, look at what those people are doing, what those people are doing, what those people are doing. And I think we need to think, wait a minute, what has the tendency in the church to not be present on a regular basis done to us and the culture that we're called to lead and speak into? Are we leading and teaching the value of Christian community and community worship, or are we leading and teaching a value of self? Now, there's good news. There's great news. This whole incident in the life of Israel, while it's a whole sermon series in itself, while it's a significant problem, and it's something major that the people have done in right out arrogance in the face of God, God restores them. He redeems them. He renews them. And while he debates with Moses about whether or not he's even gonna, he does. And he continues to lead them. He continues to call them my treasured possession. There's no shame. There's only hope. There's only restoration in the face of God's grace. I had to tell you, my hope, and I'm not kidding, I am not exaggerating here, my only hope for the future of our culture is sitting right here. It's not going to be a president or a senator or vote in Congress. It's not going to be some media report. No, it's you. It's you and me. We are the only hope that we have. I promise you that. It is the church. Is the faithfulness of the people of God to God is the only hope. So if you're sitting here and you're like, oh, I wish things were different in our culture, I got one thing. Build this body, invest in this body, love this body, and worship the God of the universe right here with us. It's the only thing that changes cultures is the worship of God. Growing and spreading. It's the only thing. I promise you that. But we can do that. We can and we will. But it won't come until we are 100% committed to community and to worship and to corporate community worship. It can change the world. Let me pray. God, thank you. Thank you for the people in the desert. That you called them to be yours, that you drew them to yourself in the first place, that you forgave them again and again and again for their failures. God, we have a greater gift of grace than even they did. We have yourself, the cross. We have the resurrection. God, help us to live committed and faithful to your covenant, to worship, to your people. God, I do pray that you would restore us and restore the world around us because of worship. It's in your name. Amen.